is my great pleasure to welcome all of you to this evening's Jeff of Westchester Identity Lecture. We are very pleased to be here in the home of Julie and Bill Levinson, our hosts. Julie is someone who's participated in our weekly women's class, and I gave her a call, and I mentioned the possibility that perhaps you could have a lecture at your home. Both Bill and Julie were very enthusiastic about the idea. So it's a pleasure to be here, and we hope that our presence here tonight and the inspiration we hopefully will gain will provide a wellspring of bracha to you and your entire family for the coming year.
Amen.
This evening's lecture is a memorial lecture. A couple that I was very close to, Hank and Susie Garfinkel, they dedicated a annual lecture in memory of their dear parents, and we hope. I never had the privilege of meeting their parents, but Susie and Ann, going back years ago, they played a very important role in the outreach work which I was doing out in Long Island before we moved up to Westchester. And we hope that the word of Torah that we will hear tonight will elevate the departed neshamos of the two sets of parents with Hashem's help. I did hear, by the way, from my Rebbe, my Rebbe Leibowitz, who was my mentor and my personal Rebbe for almost 40 years until he passed away. I once heard him say that the greatest way to elevate a departed soul in the world of eternity is by facilitating Torah study and the spread of Torah. So certainly there's a great bracha here that will be here tonight. I will tell you this. About 21 years ago, my wife and I had the privilege to attend a four-day seminar that was sponsored and organized by a organization based in Israel, an organization, probably many of you have heard of this organization, and the name is Arachim. The word Arachim means values. And to the best of my knowledge, even though fortunately we do have, and we need them, numerous Kibbutz outreach organizations in various parts of the world, including in Eretz Israel, I'm not aware of an organization that's involved in outreach work that has a higher batting average than Arachim in terms of bringing people into the fold. So I've been attending this very, very special four-day conference about 21 years ago, and Rabbi Tzvi Inbal, who was here tonight as our lecturer, he was one of the speakers. It was a very intensive program, and they had back-to-back lectures, 2 hours with at a shot, 15 minutes in between, and I got to hear Rabbi Tzvi Inbal numerous times during this four-day period, and he left a very indelible imprint in my memory. I will tell you this, that we make our plans month by month for our lecture program, and we already had in place a lecture for September. Not only that, but we even have the flyers that advertise the lecture. Going to be during the Aseret Metzuvah between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. We have an excellent speaker that's going to be happening in a home and ride. So I figured, okay, we're all set for September. Until 2 weeks ago, I got a phone call from the Arachim office in New York City, and they told me that Rabbi Tzvi Inbal is going to be in town, and they said they would offer the opportunity for us to present Rabbi Inbal here in Westchester. So I jumped at the opportunity, and I figured we're all familiar with the Big Bang Theory. So I figured this is our first lecture of the season. We wanted to start off with a big bang. So we have Rabbi Inbal for that very wonderful purpose. Rabbi Inbal is a very fascinating individual. He's multifaceted in terms of the areas that he's involved in. Since he is involved with Arachim, that makes him qualified to be a world traveler. As I mentioned, Rabbi Inbal, he arrived yesterday from Yerushalayim, and he already spoke last night. He gave a lecture, and he's here today complete with his jet lag. And we're going to hear very shortly. And of course, to get back home, he actually and his family, they live in Far Hasidim, and they're going to, instead of going east, Rabbi Inbal is going to be flying west to Los Angeles, where he's going to give a lecture next Sunday. So we are first of all very, very grateful to the Arachim organization for giving us the opportunity to present Rabbi Inbal. Aside from the fact that Rabbi Inbal has a very profound wisdom and the capability of sharing his wisdom with others in terms of Torah knowledge. He also his primary occupation is as the chief chemist of Dynamic Laboratories, which is based in Ashdod. So as you can see, he's got his finger in a lot of pie. And without further ado, I would like at this time to present Rabbi Tzvi Inbal. And it's a combo. It's a great honor and a privilege to have you with us. I will say that I hope it won't be another 21 years until we have you back for a lecture.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you, Rabbi Lechi. Thanks to the host, Epson Center. Very happy to be here. And first, I need to make an announcement. The topic that has been chosen, the bang, and it is a little too technical. And I decided to pick up the more relevant and important topic that is relevant to the military and political situation in Israel and to our future. I call this the realization of prophecy. I think it is a big bang, a spiritual big bang. The subtitle is actually, Do the Jews Defy the Rules of History? In the extremely difficult situation that we experience in Israel, of course, I think the thought that fills everybody's mind is, so what's going to happen in the future? What's going to happen tomorrow? We get up in the morning tomorrow, what will be the headline? And on 31st of December every calendar year, the great newspapers have a special edition, interviewing astrologers. Prophets, what's going to happen next year? Now, this is all, an understatement. Highly inaccurate, well guess. Nothing to do with knowledge. Besides, if you take 10 or 20 people and everyone makes, 5 suggestions, inevitably one or two will be right. No, there's going to be a revolution, there's going to be a war, there's going to be a natural disaster. Okay. Foretelling the future is technically and logically impossible. First of all, human beings have free will. In other words, the choices that people make, the leaders, all everybody that is involved in the social interactions that determine the future. Free will means it is not predetermined. And we are dealing with thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of people. In other words, there's no way of telling what's going to happen in the future. We have one way of trying to make an intelligent guess. The past is a clue to the future. History repeats itself. But this is not a prophecy, it's just merely making an intelligent guess, kind of extrapolation. But I'd like to offer to you a text that I think you all know well, from a very, very special point of view, looking at the Torah as a blueprint of Jewish history. And the claim is very simple. Jewish history does not follow the pathway of human history. It's totally different. It's based on a totally different principle. And it can be demonstrated very easily. That's what I'm going to do. And then, of course, we will have a totally different perspective on the future. Now, looking at all our enemies here is really depressing. Such a small territory, there's not even enough space to write the name Israel here. I'd say that what we desperately need is an extremely stupid insurance company that will be ready to insure the state of Israel. In fact, one of our leaders made the following announcement: our situation is plummeting from hopeless to desperate. Now, is that so? Is it really so? First of all, it's very important to keep in mind that the prophet is not a person who somehow is able to look through a hole into the future, you know, kind of a trick that you peek into the future. Prophecy is a spiritual virtue. If you want to test the prophets, then there are some prerequisites that I think are logically necessary. First of all, the prophecy must be written in a clear and unambiguous language that needs no interpretation. If the prophecy lends itself to interpretation, then it's subjective. And I'll demonstrate it in several minutes. It's subjective. Everyone offers his own interpretation, and the proof simply this. It must be referring to events which cannot be foreseen or extrapolated from the history of other nations. Prophecies like there's going to be a revolution or whatever are meaningless because it happens every now and then. There's nothing special about it. It must be documented prior to the occurrence of events. This is needless to say. But sometimes with ancient documents it's very difficult to date them. I've summarized it all with one sentence. The prophecy must undertake the risk, or, to put it more technically, it must be falsifiable. In other words, if you offer the prophecy and we want to test it, taking the risk means that there is theoretically a possibility of refuting it. If there's no such possibility, there's no meaning to it. Do you accept these restrictions? Do they make sense to you? Would anyone like to offer another restriction or a prerequisite for checking prophecies? You're welcome. I trust that these are just the name. Here's an interesting question. Is there any other religion that offers a prophecy that is falsifiable? I mean, you can promise whatever in the afterlife. Nobody will complain. But what about this world? Olam Hazeh. Do you know of any other religion that offers prophecy? There's one. Not even one, actually. No. In a way, it's sort of. And this is Christianity. Here is a quotation from the Civita Cattolica, 1987. 1,827 years have passed since Yeshua of Nazareth prophesied that Jerusalem would be destroyed and that the Jews would be exiled as slaves among the nations and remain scattered to the end of time. This is a chutzpah. It's not a Jewish chutzpah. It's a Christian chutzpah. You know why? claiming that this is a prophecy of Yeshua? Come on. It's a prophecy of the Bible, of Jeremiah, Yirmiyahu, Yeshayahu. It's the Torah itself in the Parshas HaShavuot. He takes this is really a chutzpah, but okay. Let's turn a blind eye on this. According to the Holy Scriptures, it is incumbent on the Jewish people to live forever scattered and wandering among the Gentile nations in order to provide testimony to Yeshua, not only via the body, but by means of their very existence. Now, fortunately, the end. Being that Jerusalem has now been rebuilt to become a center for the renewed Israeli state, we are duly bound to add that this is in direct contradiction to Yeshua's own prophecy. Even allowing for the for a claim which is not correct, that Yeshua had really made such a prophecy. So there is one prophecy claiming to relate to Olam Hazeh, and it had been falsified. So foretelling the future is a very risky business. Literally impossible. As I said, prophet is not technically just a person who will deliver information. It's the peak of spiritual achievement. And there were certain prophets that Hashem had given them information, and the information that we have could be tested, that will subject it to the restrictions that I offer. Let me demonstrate the first restriction. Sometimes we hear that the claim that Nostradamus, or Michel de Nostradamus, who lived in the 16th century, was a prophet. And he, there are many books. I personally have purchased 20 years ago 7 different books by seven different authors who claim that not only that he was a great prophet, but they offer the interpretation of his prophecies to demonstrate what a prophet he was. Actually, he is the only person who, well, he didn't make the claim, but his followers, his believers, claim that he was a genuine prophet. And you can demonstrate it, just read his prophecies, and you can see for yourself. But it's not so simple. I quote from the Skeptical Inquirer. Nostradamus compiled his predictions in groups of hundreds called centuries, not century as a period of 100 years, but 100 quatrains. Each prophecy is in the form of a quatrain or 4-line verse. Unfortunately, since the quatrains are extremely obtuse, written in archaic French, even for the 16th century, and touch in elaborate symbolism and code, according to believers, these quatrains only become clear after the event. They require not only translation but also interpretation. That leaves the passage open for almost any interpretation. Now, you may say, okay, so these dissidents, they are not believers, don't believe them. They are just, you know, they are biased. Okay. Consider, too, the great difficulty of arriving at even a consensus translation of the verses due to the non-standard language, the puns, and the seemingly invented words. Evidently, many errors and changes were made by the printer, too. Okay. We're told that there is no temporal sequence implied by the order in which the quatrains were written. The term century was not meant to refer to a period of time, and that a statement may refer to any past, present, or future event. That doesn't make life easy. Okay, let me demonstrate. I've chosen one quatrain. And I've chosen it because the believers, the Nostradamus believers, are very, very zealous about it. Okay. The great one, this of course is not the original language. The original language is archaic French. It's a translation offered by Erika Chittenberg. The great one, thunderstruck, is fallen in one day for not wanting to consent to the divorce. The people of Albion will go against Rome. Fire in the sky at 45 degrees. That's it. Okay? So, What is he talking about here? Anyone has an idea? Let me enlighten you. Sorry?
Fall of the Roman Empire.
Falling of the Roman Empire. Okay. Did the Roman Empire fall in one day, or at least suddenly?
No.
Hardly, I think, right?
Britain.
Now, what about the people of Albion going against them? Who are the people of Albion?
The British.
Did the British have to do with the collapse of the Roman Empire? Not that I know.
No, go against the Vatican.
It's a little difficult. Okay. Here is the first interpretation. And I think it's Erika Chittam. And she will vow that every word is perfect. And here is the interpretation. The great one is the Catholic Church in England. Fallen in one day, loses its power in one day. Okay, the great one is the Catholic Church, and Poland losing its power. Why? Because for not wanting to consent to the divorce. Okay, so it was King Henry VIII who wanted to divorce Catherine of Aragon and marry, I think it was Anne Boleyn. Okay, but the Pope did not want to consent to the divorce. I think it's a perfect explanation, right? Now, what about England? The people of Albion were going against Rome. England goes against Rome. The king confiscated all the property of the church, and he established the Anglican Church. Perfect. Now, what about fire in the sky for 5 degrees? Well, believe it or not, in the year 1531, slightly different, but we'll see. The comet Halley was observed in the sky at 45 degrees. Wow. I think it's a wow, right? Perfect match. Well, this is a little vague because the degree depends on the vantage point. The degree is different in England, in the French Riviera and Switzerland, but okay, let's be a little lenient about it. The problem is that if you open a different book, there is another interpretation. But even though not, it's as convincing as the first one, but slightly different. By the way, did you notice something wrong with this? There's something much more problematic. The year 1531. It's not a prophecy, ladies and gentlemen, because it was at the time of Michel de Nostradamus. He was alive at that time. Okay. I can only quote. Okay, who is the great one? Mussolini, the great Italian leader. Thunderstruck, is born in one day, falls from his office in one day. Why? Because he opposed to the will of his advisors and people. They requested him to divorce Italy from Nazi Germany. Divorce is not only breaking up marriage, divorce is also breaking up the pact. Okay? Divorce Italy from Nazi Germany and sign a peace pact with the Allies. Again, it fits perfectly. And what happened is, he offered his resignation to King Emmanuel. King Emmanuel said, thank you very much, resignation accepted, then, and that's it. In one day. Why? Okay, the people of Albion will go against Rome. England invades Italy. What about 45 degrees fire? Okay, the great airstrike of the Allies in the Ploiești oil fields in Romania. The fire, so witnesses say, could be seen from 250 kilometers. So it was up high in the sky. Okay, so who's right? That's the problem with prophecies that do not meet your requirements. You have to comply with the basic requirements if you want to prove your point. So much for that. Let's start with the Torah, the document that I want to quote, and the Jewish people. First of all, it's a unique thing, a history of over 3,400 years. After independence of about 850 years, the entire nation is exiled for 70 years and then returns to their homeland. There was a prophecy, by the way, that the exile will be exactly 70 years. And this is what happened. And the figure 70 years is not arbitrary. Does anyone know why 70 years? 70 Shemitahs that they have not observed. A year of exile for a Shemitah that they have not observed. It was almost 40% of the time. In other words, the entire history from conquering the land until the first exile, 40% of the time they did not keep the Shemitah. It was exactly 70 years. And then they return after another period of 420 years, a second exile. And this one was long, horrible. 1900 years, the second in gathering of the exile. Really. What about the exile? Persecution, extermination, almost universal. Blood libels, anti-Semitism, repetitive expulsions. Now, it's not only the nation that was persecuted, the Torah also was persecuted. For several times, wagon loads of Torah books, handwritten, thousands and thousands of them were gathered and burned at stake. Now, it is very important to keep in mind that the document, the Torah, I call it the document, okay? Sounds technical. That the document had been written prior to the events. We have the official translation, the Septuagint, which is about 2259 years ago, and of course I think you would agree that it's impossible to translate a book that doesn't exist. So the Torah had been written prior to the events that I'm going to describe. I'm going to refer to the second exile, not the first exile. The Torah had been written prior to the events, and it also had been distributed. Once it was translated, it had been distributed throughout the entire Roman Empire. So there's no conceivable way of any person who could change it, rewrite it after the event. The Torah itself, it's a living document. It's not some obscure manuscript unearthed with a very, very bizarre language that you have to somehow decipher. Consider the Egyptian hieroglyphs. Until the 18th century, when Champollion was able, with a very brilliant work, to decipher the language, it was just, it was Chinese. I think the Americans say about something like this, it's Chinese to me, right? Okay, so. And even though after it had been translated, there's no certainty about the translation. Probably quite reasonable, but there's always the element of doubt. We are talking about the document, it's a living document. The language is a living language. Consider a fantastic thing. An Israeli child, 6-7 years old, can take a book that had been written thousands of years ago and understand it. There's no other example of any other such language. It's written a long time before the events. And from the beginning, the book was introduced as a prophecy outlining the future of the Jewish people. It's not that somebody said, look what a coincidence. Here is a book describing something. Lo and behold, what a strange coincidence. It describes our history. No. The Torah says, this is what is going to happen. Write the book, keep it with you, because it will testify for the future. Here is the exact, I think I have the exact question in a minute. Let's start with a very important and basic prophecy. And this is the eternity of the Jewish people. The Torah says, even at the terrible times, the exile, in spite of this, however, when they are in the land of the enemies, I will not reject them and abhor them to make a complete end of them, to break my covenant with them, for I am the Lord, therefore. We have a covenant issue. the prophet Malachi says, "For I am God, I do not change. You are the children of Jacob, you will not cease to be." What inspires me most is the words of Yirmiyahu, Jeremiah. He compares the existence of the Jewish nation to the existence of the laws of nature. It's really fantastic. "Thus says God, who establishes the sun to light the day, the laws of the moon and stars to light the night, who strips up the sea into roaring waves, whose name is the Lord of hosts. If these natural laws should ever give way before me, says God, only then shall the offspring of Israel cease to be a nation before me for all time." God tells us, you are going to be as everlasting as the laws of nature itself. Now, of course, you can write whatever you like. Only the imagination limits you. But we live after the fact. We are here. 3,400 years of Jewish history, and we are still here. Now, it was not a peaceful history. Consider the most extremely unlikely conditions for survival. You want to offer eternity to a nation. How? Start with a huge nation. Hundreds of millions of people. With a huge territory surrounded by geographical boundaries. Take the Chinese people, for example. You have the Pacific Ocean. You cannot cross the Pacific Ocean. On the eastern side, you have the Pacific Ocean. You have the Himalaya chain of mountains. You have the Gobi Desert. What else? Okay, so you have the Chinese wall also. Unconquerable. Okay. Maybe under these conditions, a nation, you can promise that the nation will survive for 1,000 years, for 2,000 years, maybe. But the Torah prescribes a totally different history. You'll be almost a very small nation, scattered among all nations. You will be the subject of universal hatred. Everyone, literally everyone, will try to exterminate you. You'll have no ally, no borders that can defend, no weapon to defend yourself. Yet, everybody, every empire will rise and fall. Rise and fall. You can find all the empires in the museums, archaeological digging, and you will persist throughout this. This is ridiculous. The Torah says, promises the eternity of the Torah to not only the nation, in the book of Devarim, the Deuteronomy. "Now write for yourselves this song and teach it to the Israelites. Make them memorize it so that this will be a witness for some witness." I think there's a mistake here in the translation. I'm not quite sure. It's not my own translation. Okay, but the word witness is mentioned. The Torah will be a witness to the Israelites. Moses finished writing the words of this Torah in the scroll to the very end. Moses then gave orders to the Levites, who carried the Ark of God's covenant, saying, "Take this Torah scroll and place it to the side of the Ark of God, your Lord's covenant, leaving it there as a witness." In the Ark of the Covenant, nobody is inaccessible to human beings. Nobody can change it. Nobody can modify it. It's virtually protected. "When they are then beset by many evils," at the end of the days, "and troubles, this song shall testify for them like the witness, since it will not be forgotten by their descendants." The Torah will not be forgotten, and it will serve as a witness. "Don't say that I didn't warn you. I warned you. I provided the document that will accompany you throughout history. You will read it all the time. It's there. It will serve as a witness." The prophet Isaiah also offers eternity of his Torah. "As for me, this is my covenant with them, says God. My spirit, which rests upon you, and my words, which I have put in your mouth, shall not depart from your mouth, not from the mouth of your children, nor from the mouth of your children's children, says God, from now on to all eternity." So promising eternity to the nation and to the Torah. The Torah starting point. What about the exile? This is in Parashat Shavuot. That's what we're going to read on Shabbat. I have chosen only a few pieces because we have limited time. Let's start with, God will scatter you among the nations from one end of the earth to the other. This is unique. No other nation in ancient history or modern history had ever been exiled in such a way. Exile was very common. The Romans were probably the top experts in the world. You cannot rule a country where the people lived in their forefathers' fields and you want to subdue them, inevitably they will revolt. Just move them to another country, a foreign country. What happened universally was assimilation. All the ancient nations, or almost all of them, are gone. The names are preserved in the Torah. Arvadi, Atzmari, these are names, nobody heard them. They simply dissipated into history. But take a nation, scatter it among all the nations. This is unique and illogical, but it happens. You know, scientists very often argue there's life on Mars. Maybe there is life, there's no life. Sometimes I make the statement, there's no life on Mars. How do you know? If life had existed on Mars, then we already would have had a Chabad branch. If you look at the map, I don't even have to quote the figures. Almost every inhabitable part, before excluding Tierra del Fuego or Alaska or Fiji Islands, every major civilization, every major culture. It's incredible. God will scatter you among all the nations. And then the next verse. Among those nations, you will feel insecure. And there will be no place for your food to rest. Expulsion is so inhuman. Try to imagine. 1492, King Ferdinand and Queen Helena issue a decree. In 2 weeks, no living Jew remains in Spain. Either he converts or he's picked up. You cannot even sell your house, your property, nobody will buy it. In 2 weeks, they simply step in and that's it. Elderly people, ladies, babies, children, sick people. How? By cars, by trains, by planes, ships. How? So cruel and inhuman. And it repeats itself exactly point to prophecy. Here's just an overview, expulsion between the year 1000 and 1500 from era. Major expulsion. I'm just looking from west, moving from west to east, not according to chronological order. Portugal, Spain, Navarra, Provence, France, England, Wales, Sardinia, Sicily, Hungary, Austria, Germany, Schlesia, Krim, Lita. Incredible. Here is a list. I'm not going to read all of them, just to demonstrate the universal expulsion. Starting with the year 215, Carthage, Alexandria, France, Spain, Italy, Mainz, Germany, France, England, France, Switzerland, Germany, Hungary, Strasbourg, Germany again, Zurich, Cologne, Mainz, Breslau. There are all in all, I've compiled 60 different expulsions. And I don't pretend to have the list complete. This this refers to the Nazi Germany. Okay, 1948 expulsion of about half a million Jews from the Arab countries for political reasons. So again, a unique prophecy No other country has ever endured something similar to this. 1, 2, 3, 5, 10, 50, 60 on history, it's hundreds of expulsions. According to the blueprint. The next verse is Hashem will give you there an anguished heart, an eyes that pine, and a despondent spirit. The life you face should be precarious. You should be in terror night and day with no assurance of survival. In the morning you shall say, if only it were evening, and in the evening you shall say, if only it were morning, because of what your heart shall dread and your eyes shall see. Does this describe the Jewish people under the Nazi occupation, under the Soviet occupation, under the Spanish Inquisition, or maybe in Portugal, maybe in South America, maybe everywhere? A horrible situation, unlike any other nation, again and again and again and again, awful. The next sentence is absolutely fantastic. Condensing in one sentence three very important aspects. The English translation here is, I think, King James Version. No, it's a very, very poor translation according to my humble view. And here is the original Hebrew. והיית לשמע למשל ולשנינה בכל העמים אשר נקח של שם. שמע is from השמדה, שממה. Eradication. Everybody will try to exterminate you. משל is dehumanization. Demonization. שנינה like ושיננתם לבניך. Everybody will talk about it. In all the nations which Hashem will drive you there. Now, universal hatred, we're very familiar with it. Anti-Semitism is something that defies any rational explanation. The universality, the intensity, the duration, and irrationality are not only the features of anti-Semitism, but it stands out as something that has nothing to do with historical phenomena, with known historical phenomena. People always hate minorities. Even today, in the Enlightenment era, take Canada, Quebec, this dissonance situation is much more serious. Take, for example, the Indians and the Sikhs, Sikhi, I don't know how they are called actually, in Hebrew they're called Sikhi. Take, for example, the Irish people and the English people, they hate each other. They sometimes plant bombs, they fight each other. People hate minorities. But, for example, in Belgium, you have the Flemish and the Wallons, right? They don't like each other. But they have nothing to do with the Kurdish people or the Sikhs or the Irish people. It's a local phenomenon. Unfortunately, it's not a virtue of your people. We hate minorities. Or we dislike them. But the Jewish people, universal hatred, let's decide any explanation. Libel and pogroms, again, I'm not going to read all this. I think you're familiar with the facts. It's a horror story. What about demonization? Well, that's me. You know, we are the scum of the earth, right? Aren't we? Ask the rest of the world. They will confirm it. Let's keep. Martin Gilbert, Jewish history analyst. But as my research into Jewish history progressed, I was surprised, depressed, and to some extent overwhelmed by the perpetual and irrational violence which pursued the Jews in every century and to almost every corner of the globe. If therefore persecution, expulsion, torture, humiliation, mass murder haunt these pages, it is because they also haunt the Jewish story. Lloyd George, all the extreme fanaticism that plays havoc in men's nature, there is not one as irrational as anti-Semitism. The Jews cannot vindicate themselves in the eyes of these fanatics. If the Jews are rich, they are victims of theft. If they are poor, they are victims of ridicule. If they take sides in the war, it's because they wish to take advantage from the spilling of non-Jewish blood. If they espouse peace, it is because they are scared by the nature of prejudice. If the Jew dwells in a foreign land, he is persecuted and expelled. If he wishes to return to his own land, he is prevented from doing so eternally. For example, in the eyes of the British Academy, who are the villains? Is it the radical Islam terrorists? No, it's us, the neo-Nazis. We. So I think that this is a very good description. Ra'ita l'shama l'mashal. What about Shnina? They will talk about you. From the article Concerning the Jews in Harper's Magazine by Mark Twain. Here is his description. If these statistics are right, the Jews constitute but 0.5% of the human race. It's actually 1/5. It suggests a nebulous dimpup of stardust, lost in the blaze of the Milky Way. Probably, the Jew ought hardly to be heard of, but he's heard of, has always been heard of. He's as prominent on the planet as any other people, and his commercial importance is extravagantly out of proportion to the smallness of his bulk. His contributions to the world's list of great names in literature, science, art, music, finance, and abstruse learning are also way out of proportion to the weakness of his numbers. He has made a marvelous fight in this world in all the ages and has done it with his hands tied behind him. He could be vain of himself and be excused for it. The Egyptians, the Babylonians, and the Persians rose, filled the planet with sound and splendor, then faded to dream stuff and passed away. The Greek and the Roman followed and made a vast noise, and they are gone. Other peoples have sprung up and held their torch high for a time, but it burned out and they sit in twilight now or have vanished. The Jew saw them all, beat them all, and is now what it always was, exhibiting no decadence, no infirmities of age, no weakening of his parts, no slowing of his energies, no dulling of his alert and aggressive mind. All things are mortal, but the Jew. All other forces pass, but he remains. What's the secret of his immortality? It's very interesting. You see, how many Jews are there in Israel? 7 million. Okay. There's a joke in Israel. When David Levy was a foreign minister, and Israel had established political and economic relations with China. So he is a foreign minister, visited China. He was, there was a meeting with the from the Chinese foreign minister or some type of you. Shalom Aleichem, I'm David Levy, Israeli foreign minister. Welcome. From where are you? Israel. How many people do you have? We already have 7 million. The foreign minister says, well, very nice. And in which hotel do you stay, please? Come on. The world is big. There's so many powers and superpowers, so many problems, so many genocides. Wow. How is it possible then that there's no week, not a single week in which Israel is not mentioned in all the media? What about the proportion? Take Switzerland. I think 8.5 million people, the same order of magnitude, okay? When does Switzerland hit the front news in the media? Once in a decade? Oh, once in a year? Maybe I'm a little exaggerated. I remember very clearly when Switzerland hits the news. Last time it was, I think, when the Geneva Convention for Human Rights. Out of, I believe, several hundreds decrees and statements made, 40% were against Israel. as if there's no other problems. No genocide in Darfur, somebody wherever you like. So they were condemning Israel. So was it Israel in the news or Switzerland? The other time that I remember was concerning the gold, the stolen gold in the Swiss banks. Again, was it Switzerland or was it the Jewish money that wasn't there? So people keep talking about Jewish nation. One last point I want to make that I think is very well known is the impact that Jews all over the world have over the world, the entire world. Let's take Nobel Prizes, representing science, medicine, economy. So there is over 1 billion Muslims in the world. You know how many Muslims have won Nobel Prize? 9. Including a very particular tzaddik. Okay. In the list, interestingly enough, in the list, there's also the name of Albert Camus, who won the Nobel Prize for Literature. I don't know how suddenly he was not a Muslim. He was born in Algiers, but he was a French person. Okay, granted, 9. So it's over 1 billion Muslims. Now, there are, maybe say, but over 40 billion Jews around the world. Unfortunately, from the beginning of the lecture, we have lost already 100 persons in the nation. In short, there are 14 million. That's all.
Yeah.
14 million Jews. You know how many Nobel Prizes they have won? Any guess? Well, a little more than 9. Let me give you a hint. Almost 350. Most of them in science, in physics, medicine. Take just the last year, in chemistry and physics, in chemistry and medicine. Adelonat, Chefanobel, Hirschko, Chefman, and Uma, Rosenman, and Kahneman, and two of the last three, eight Israelis. Two of them are Israelis who live in America. Over 350. It's way out of proportion. So people will talk about it. Vaita leshama lemashal veleshnina. Strange, more than strange. Irrational, illogical, but fair. Let's consider the Jewish population throughout history. The Torah says, where you were once as numerous as the stars of the sky, the survivors among you during the exile will be few in number, all because you did not obey God your Lord. You will be few in number. You could have been as numerous as the stars. Here is the estimated number of Jews according to Karta Atlas throughout history, and here it is in thousands. The numbers here refer to thousands. So 2,000 is 2 million, 4 million, etc., etc. Here is the timetable. You will notice that throughout almost entire history, the figure was never higher than 6 million Jews. Most of the time, it's much less. By the period of emancipation and industrialization resulting in the advance of medicine, etc., etc., the numbers start rising until 1940, which was the almost 17 million people. The record, entire history record. And then, unfortunately, one third. So, how on earth can you make a prophecy? The nation is going to be eternal. Yet everybody will try to kill them, to decimate the nation. Universal hatred. You will never be able to defend yourself. You will be scattered. And your numbers will be few. What would have happened, God forbid, if the diagram would just touch the zero number? That's the end of the story. Quenching the light. So it appears to me that God purposefully let us know. He promised eternity. But in order to demonstrate that He is the ultimate force responsible for history behind the scenes, you know, like a puppet show. Somebody actually is pulling the strings, but we don't see it. He's the one. By providing the absurd circumstances, and yet, here we are. That's a very great demonstration of His power. He's controlling history. Now, towards the end of the exile, I've chosen one example. The Torah promises us that the land of Israel is going to be extremely fruitful. God, your Lord, is bringing you to a good land, a land with flowing streams, underground streams, etc., etc. A wonderful, you know, the slogan of the Israeli tourist administration is a land of milk and honey. Okay. Now, what would you recommend in order to have very good produce? You want to have a lot of food, high quality. What would you take care of? Start with choice of seeds, right? We want the best seeds. What else? Provide water. Oil.
Sun.
Sorry?
Sun.
The sun. Yes.
Soil.
Good soil, whatever.
Fertilizers.
What else? You have to spray, you know, insecticides, all those kind of enemies. Okay? Rain, good. Now the Torah offers a totally different prescription. You want to keep the lands super fertile? Keep them mitzvot. Shabbat, Shemitah, purity of the family, Lashon Hara. That's what will keep the land at least. If you don't observe the mitzvot, says the Torah, there will come time that you will be expelled from the country and the country will remain desolate. When you will return, the country will also change and return to it. Let's look at the worst point in history. At the time of the destruction of the Second Temple. The country already declined. It's not what it was at the time of the First Temple. Josephus Flavius is a historian. He was a historian who lived at that period. His history books were accepted by the Jewish people and by the Romans. Of course, nobody trusts at least the part which he describes his own role in Yodpat. But generally speaking, the books are considered history written at the time of the events. Here is how he describes the Galilee. So that's where I live, in fact. I live in the southern part of the Galilee. For the whole area is excellent for crops of pastures and rich in trees of every kind, so that by its fertility it invites even those least inclined to work in the land. In fact, every inch of it has been cultivated by the inhabitants, and not a parcel goes to waste. It is thickly covered with towns, and thanks to the natural abundance of the soil, the many villages are so densely populated that the smallest of them has more than 15,000 inhabitants. All I can say is, wow. Like, it doesn't look it. Far from this. Yeah, there's one major city, Carmiel, about 60,000, population of 60,000. The rest scattered in their very, very small villages. Most of the area belongs to the Arabs. Live there. There's 500,000 Arabs living there. Name like Kabul, Tamra, Sakhlin, Bir Hana, Iblin. It's not desolate, but near. This was the situation prior to the destruction of the temple. So we can only imagine what it was in the book here. And the Torah promises it's going to become worse. So devastated will I leave the land that your enemies who shall dwell therein shall be desolate. Nachmanides, commentary by the Ramban 800 years ago. Similarly, that which is stated here, and your enemies that shall dwell therein shall be desolate in it, constitutes a good tidings. There's a point of light in the darkness, because the Torah calls the occupants enemies. They will not become the owners of the land. This is what the Ramban is pointing. Yes, you will not be in Israel. You will be exiled, dispersed. But the country will not be owned by any other nation. It will remain desolate. Proclaiming that during all our exile, our land will not accept our enemies. This also is a great proof and assurance to us. For in the whole inhabited parts of the world, one cannot find such a good and large land, which was always lived in, and yet is as ruined as it is today. At the time of Aquinas, and actually up until about 100 years ago. For since the time that we left it, it has not accepted any nation or people, and they all try to settle it, but to no avail. Now, let's skip 800 years. Let's go back to the beginning of the 20th century. So the Torah says that while the Jewish people will be in the Golus, in the exile, the land will be desolate, the enemies will occupy it, but the land itself will not be owned by any nation, will not be claimed even by any nation. Now, what happened after the First World War, after the collapse of the Ottoman Empire? There was a new order. There was never a doubt about Egypt. Egypt had been conquered by General Allenby and the British Army, but of course it was Egypt, it belonged to the Egyptians, and the British Army just left it as it is. The same with Syria, Iran, which was called, actually was called Persia at that time, Persia. There was no problem, of course, with Turkey and Saudi Arabia. What about Palestine? There was nobody who claimed, thank you very much for returning us the land, because nobody claimed that the Palestine was its homeland. And that is very strange, like the Ramban says. This is why the British mandate was actually just an appointment by the United Nations, just to keep things in order. They did not occupy the land, they just maintained order, or what they thought was order. We have a different opinion, generally. So when they left, they were not expelled from their country. They just left because they had nothing to do with Israel. We just imagine. Take Switzerland again. Let's imagine that all the occupants decided that they don't like the weather and they want to move to, Hong Kong. Okay. No, Hong Kong is too crowded. Okay. Somewhere else, New Zealand. And then after 50 years or 100 years, they decide it's time to return. What do you think would have happened in this imaginary scenario? Do you think that Switzerland would have remained desolate, empty, with here and there some scattered shepherds? Of course not. Of course not. 5 minutes after the last person leaves the country, everybody would try, all those neighbors would try to conquer a share. Germany, Italy, everybody. So how is it possible then that the Torah promises that the land and Palestine is at the intersection of three continents, Africa, Asia, and Europe, is coveted by so many empires, and yet when the Jewish people had returned, it belonged to nobody? This is what the Torah says. There's a description here was given by Mark Twain, Sir John William Dawson, Alphonse de Lamartine, describing the desolation of the land. And here is a prophecy that refers to the end of the days. And here the prophet speaks to the land, to the soil, the country, not the people. But you, O mountains of Israel, shall yield your produce and bear your fruit for my people of Israel, for their return is near. Our sages explain in the Talmud, Sanhedrin, page 98. Rabbi Abba also said, there can be no more manifest sign of redemption than this, what he says, but you, O Mountains of Israel, you shall yield your produce, etc., etc. The first exile every Jewish person knew will take 70 years, because there was a prophecy, and the prophet had lived during the destruction, Jeremiah. And everybody knew it's going to be 70 years. The second exile, everybody knew it's going to be very long, and very horrible, and nobody knew the end. It appears in the book of Daniel, towards the end of the book of Daniel. It's going to be long, and nobody will be able to know when. Says the Talmud, when is actually the beginning of the end? The turning point, when the people of Israel start returning and the country again will become green, will start producing. It's like a widow, Pastor. A widow, not exactly a widow. Her husband is alive, but he left her. And she's mourning back, and when he returns, she presses again like the talent. The country will wait. The land, the soil, the mountains will wait for the children. When they return, they will start again producing the super, shall I say, something simply unnatural. We have witnessed this with our own eyes. You know, everybody speaks about the 67, prior to 67 war, border, that's the green line. It's called the green line. Why? There's a theory saying that in the British mandate maps, somebody depicted the border with a green pen. Maybe. Maybe. But I can tell you, I have my own explanation. During the Yom Kippur War, I was an officer in the army, and actually, being a chemist, during my service in the army, most of the time, I was a commander of a very large laboratory, R&D and all of military projects. But during the war, since I was an officer, I was there was a problem with the hormone, something that had to do with chemistry. And they picked me up from the front, and they sent me on a plane to Ospina, and then they picked me up and brought me to the hormone. So during the war, I had flown with a plane over from south to north Israel. I remember the flight for many, many reasons, but one of them was I could see the border. The west part was green. You know, we call it the small and the large triangles. It's not actually triangles. If you remember the map of Israel, a tiny country. I could see the border here. This protrusion is Jerusalem, and then the large area which belonged to the Arabs. Everything here was desolate, barren, yellow, brown. This was the eastern side. The west side was green. When the Jewish people returned, things changed. You will not believe it. Israel, tiny Israel, is a world superpower in agriculture. Of course, not from point of view of tons or thousands of tons, from point of view of agro technology, from point of view of world records in many, many yields, crops. It's amazing. Israel is selling modern agricultural technologies to most of the countries. And by the way, one specific Israeli invention, I think, will save the world. Maybe it's a little exaggerated, but I'm not sure. You know what I'm talking about? Desalination. No. Desalination has nothing to do with agriculture. Let me tell you. You probably have heard about the world is heating up. Global warming. There's a process ongoing in the last 20 years, and it's probably growing exponentially. And this is process of desertification. Here in the United States, I think the major victim is California. California has a water crisis. The world is going to suffer in unheard of desertification and shortage in water. There's one Israeli invention, such a brilliant invention. It's going to save the world. You know what it is? Drip irrigation. Believe it or not, when I heard about it, I said, well, yes, of course. Why didn't they ask me? It's such a simple idea. That's the brilliance. That's the genius of the idea. It's incredible. In short, Israel is an agricultural superpower, of course, in proportion to its size. So the prophecy came true. What the prophecy basically says, you start with a fantastic land. You will not observe the mitzvot. I will expel you from the country. The country will remain desolate. Your enemies will occupy it for a very long period. And then when you start returning, the land again will welcome you and return to its use. We have witnessed with our own eyes. It's irrational. It has nothing to do with science or agriculture, but the facts speak for themselves. One last point. The indefinite period. We have seen the prophecy. The Lord will scatter you among all nations from one end of the earth to the other. This by itself is a fantastic prophecy. It cannot be extrapolated. It cannot be compared with any other nation, and it's universal. And it came true. What's more from this is simply mind-boggling to me. The Torah promises towards the end of the book, God will then bring back your remnants and have mercy on you. Hashem, your Lord, will once again gather you from among all the nations where He scattered you. Even if your diaspora is at the end of the heavens, Hashem, your Lord, will gather you up from there and will take you back. Imagine 100 years ago, 200 years ago, somebody would say, oh yes, sure, we'll return to Israel. What would they? Rational person say, I sympathize with you, you know. You suffer so much in the diaspora that you're simply out of your mind. I understand. You're just, you know, you're hallucinating. You're just hallucinating. I mean, don't entertain these foolish ideas. You're returning nowhere. Nobody, no nation had ever been exiled and returned. Not to mention, say, 1600 years. Look at yourself. Come on. Be realistic. We are very realistic because we have a map, and the author of the map has demonstrated again and again and again that he has the power to execute his plan. And here we are. We have seen it with our own eyes. It's such an incredible privilege. We live in such an era. We see that history starts moving faster. It's paced faster and faster towards the end of the days. All pieces of the puzzle have to be put together. The Torah also claims that there's going to be a children moving, because, as Maimonides writes, the Torah teaches us that the Jewish nation will be redeemed only by children. That's the only one. Either we make children out of love, or because of horrible trouble. Either way, it's only children that has the power to bring redemption. And what we see, at least I can tell you that I've been witnessing the Chuva movement at least in the last 4 years. It's a snowball. It started with, you know, 2 or 3 here and there, and it started snowballing. Arachim started 35 years ago with the first seminar. There were at that time 1 week seminars. And people said, you're out of your mind. No, you're a bunch of crazy guys. Do you think that the secular people will come and spend 1 week with poor people and they will pay for it? You're out of your mind. And they came. They came. And it was such an important experience for them that they recommended their friends, relatives. So we started with the second seminar. We started with 3 seminars a year. And then 5, and then in the last years, Arachim alone has conducted over anywhere between 100 and 200 seminars a year, most of them in Israel and 20% abroad, many, many times. I personally have been in seminars in Hong Kong, of course in Israel, in Italy, in France, in England, South Africa, Canada, United States, maybe I forgot a country, sorry, but it's incredible. Summer. An extremely unlikely survival of a unique nation under the most difficult conditions, and a unique book describing the events prior to the events in a clear language, no symbolism, no hints or clues, no poetic language, plain, simple. The entire blueprint of history, and I've only exposed you to I don't know how many percent, a very small part of it, really at any time. The entire blueprint of history is written as a prophecy in an ancient document. Generations before the event, a book that accompanies the nation to every corner of the earth and through its entire history, written explicitly and plainly in a language that is still being spoken. So, let's see, did we meet the first criteria? It must be written in a clear and unambiguous language that needs no interpretation. I think we can check this. It must be referring to events which cannot be foreseen or extrapolated from the history of other nations. Again, I think we excel in this point too. It must be documented prior to the occurrence of the events. Again, it's the bingo, because it has been written and translated many years. So, did the Torah undertake a risk, and what a risk, describing in detail a history that sounds, how shall I say, not even a science fiction. Even science fiction has its own limits of imagination. The Torah spreads beyond the boundaries of human imagination, offering a history that is unique in almost every aspect. And yet here we are, looking back, comparing the facts. I'd like to spend some 10 minutes trying to offer here a point of view concerning the situation in Israel. Let me ask you something. I'll say it fully. A natural event is defined by an event that is governed by natural causes, and therefore it repeats itself. If we observe an event with very low probability that repeats itself again and again and again, could we attribute this to natural causes? Say that Jimmy won the first prize in the national lottery. There's nothing mysterious about it. In Israel, at least, every week, a person wins the first prize. Now, let's talk about Yosuke. So Yosuke won the first prize, everybody was very happy, and he had a party to the family, and then next Thursday, guess who won the first prize? Yosuke. Could this happen? Yes. Of course, rare, but could happen. It will appear in all the papers in Israel. Wow, interview with Yosuke. Now, Yosuke is an optimist, so he, next Thursday, also bought a ticket. So he had also some money to spare, so he bought a ticket. And believe it or not, he won the third time. Three times in the world. I'm sure that this time he'll be interviewed by all the major media newspapers in the world. Because this probably would happen once in a lifetime of humanity. But it could happen. Now what happens on the fourth week if he wins? Fourth week consecutively if he wins the first time. You know who will come to interview him? The police. By the way, they will have also a few questions for the manager of the lottery company. Now, if I tell you that Yosuke had won the first prize 16 weeks consecutively, you would say, this is the difference. Coincidences occur, but if there's a string of coincidences, a long string of coincidences that all point in the same direction, inevitably we reach a point when we say, okay, stop. It's not a coincidence, it cannot be a coincidence. The same is not only for winning the lottery, okay? Yankele wanted to buy his wife a present. So he looks at the window and suddenly, believe it or not, bang, from the third floor, a baby, 3-month baby, fell down straight on Yankele's head. Baruch Hashem, the baby was saved. Yankele had surgery and then physiotherapy, and he recovered, but he wanted to buy a gift to his wife. So this time he goes to another street, just to make sure. And he says, well, I think I'll have... And suddenly, okay, it happens. You know, a transformer from a an electrical bank, surgery, physical therapy. Okay, this time he says, okay, I'm going to buy a gift in Natanya, okay? And then as he looks at the shop, he says, well, shall I buy it here or shall I buy it there? Bang. This time the flower pops. Now, you get the point. It's impossible. One day is Jimmy, the other is Mary, and the other is I don't know who. Okay. But all of them are caring for the same person again and again and again. This is not natural. Take the Jewish people. Here they were miraculously saved. Well, it's not miraculously. It's coincidences. Here another coincidence, and here another coincidence. That war, another coincidence. Here another coincidence. With that ruler, with that empire, coincidence. How many coincidences do you need in order to understand that it's not natural? There's a governing hand behind the scene. The same applies with this enemy tried to kill us, and this enemy, and this one, and this one. Everybody, all of them, universally, this would not be good. I don't have time to describe all the events. It will take hours. I have a lecture. I compiled. I spent months and months reading books and documents, compiling deliberately hundreds of fantastic coincidences. I just want to share with you two or three highlights. That's all. Let's start with the Gulf War. First of all, let me demonstrate what Scud missile can do. The last Scud, remember the Scuds? The last Scud that the Iraqis sent was toward the Saudi Arabia, and it hit a building with American soldiers. 22 Americans were killed and 60 were injured. So a Scud is not exactly pyrotechnics. It's not a chance. During the war, 39 Scud missiles were sent to Israel. First of all, it's important to remember that actually what Saddam Hussein wanted, he declared himself Salah ad-Din of the new Middle East. So what he had in mind was what everybody has in mind. Kill the Jews, drive them to the sea and plunder their country. Natural thing. This is excusable. But instead of attacking Israel, and he compiled incredible amounts of weapons, instead of marching straight to Israel, he started with Kuwait, and the rest is history. The United States warns Israel, or suggests, don't take even a single shot. We will handle the Iraqis. Let us ruin them. Stay in your homes. It's a war. Don't get out. You might be scratched. Well, they were not actually, I believe so, nobody said formally, they did not care about us. They worried that if Israel joins the war, it will disrupt the coalition. Imagine that, say, the Gulf War started in 1991. Imagine that in the year 1990, when Saddam Hussein, standing on top of an incredible pile of armament, declaring that he's going to destroy Israel, and somebody would say, hey, don't worry about him. There you are. Because the biggest army in the world, the coalition, the Americans, the British, the French, New Zealand, Canada, all will come against Saddam Hussein, will destroy him. And you know what? The Arabs will join them. The Egyptians, the Syrians, and the Saudi Arabs will also fight against him. What would you say in the year 1990? Sir, you better continue taking your medications. That's what I would have said. And a year later, what happened? International coalition, with the Arab armies, fighting Saddam Hussein, our most dangerous enemy at that time. really. So the Americans were simply afraid that they would disrupt the coalition, because the Egyptians and Syrians were ready to fight with the Americans and the British, but not with the Israelis on their side. So this is what our president Chaim Herzog said: "This is a miracle for us. Our dirty work will be done by others. The Jewish people has experienced miracles throughout its history, from the splitting of the Red Sea to this very day. Now too, we have had the merit to see divine providence standing behind us." This is what it says. Like our sages say, "Tzadikim zachu melachtam laset bidei acherim." The righteous often have the dirty work done for them by others. I remember. Okay, this is the house that had a visit of the Scots. That's the way. I remember immediately after the war, I had to fly to Ireland. Part of my work in chemistry, I had to meet with a chemical manager of a plant in Ireland, in Cork. It was two flights long. I was very tired. I was sitting in his office, having a coffee. It was in a plastic cup. I saw the look in your eyes. Okay, so I was sipping coffee. He was sitting in his chair, and the chair was next to the wall. And he was very sympathizing with me, and he said, "Well, you had a terrible war." I said, "Yes." And then I asked him, "I'll tell you something. 10,992. Flats, apartments, were hit by Scots. One third were totally destroyed. One third had to be demolished and rebuilt. And one third suffered, light damage. 10,992. Most of them were occupied with people. How many casualties do you think we have?" He said, "Well, I believe there's hundreds of casualties." I said, "Well, only one person died because of the stud. There were other casualties because of, they had heart attacks or whatever, but not because of the stud." He said, "One casualty? What do you mean one casualty?" I said, "One. I'll show you the facts." And I provided documents. I'll show you the facts. He looked at the figures, and I remember him. He was actually with his back to the wall, but somehow, I don't know how he managed to recoil. And he said, with an Irish accent, which I cannot repeat, I'm sorry, he looked at me and he said, "God protects you." I felt like I wanted to cry, because the evening before, I had a conversation with a friend of mine. He's one of the top Israeli experts on missiles. He has a doctorate from Berkeley University. He was one of the chief executives and engineers in Rafael. Don't know if you know what Rafael is. So if there is one person in Israel who is an expert on missiles, it's him. He's a fine guy, I love him very much. But he's secular, he's not a Jewish observer. But what happened is, I discussed with him the Gulf War. I provided a lot of information which I'm going to skip here, unfortunately, today. And I asked him, "Well, what do you think?" What he told me was, "You have to understand, the Scud missile was initially designed for 500 kilometers, range of 500 kilometers. The Iraqis fire it from H3 field, which is 1,000 kilometers. To increase the range, they had to decrease the amount of explosive, the explosive payload, instead of 500 kilograms, only 250 kilograms. I looked at him, and luckily, Baruch Hashem, I said nothing. Now we are still very good friends. But I thought to myself, well, I did not ask, how is it that each Scud missile only ruined 30 houses instead of 60? Man, you were in Israel, you were watching television live. What remained from the house was just a pile of rubble. Stones, metal, twisted. You have seen it. And suddenly a person emerges out counts his hands, legs, everything, removes the dead, he looks back, he doesn't believe that anybody survived. The house is flat. And here's another one. Everybody emerges alive. So, what do you mean 250 kilograms? Take a scud, which is 8 meters long. Give it a speed of 6,000 kilometers per hour. Just the kinetic energy. Fill it with Diet Coke, okay? No explosives. I'm not kidding. The kinetic energy is enough to remove two skyscrapers. So we don't need 200, a reduced payload. And I fly 4,000 kilometers. Here I speak with a chemist, whom I saw just for 3 hours my entire life. I've never spoken to him again. He looks at the face for 5 minutes and says, look, there were so many miracles. Every sky has its own story. Every sky, I tell you only about two. This is Mickey. By the way, this is not Photoshop. This is authentic. I can vouch for it. You can find it in the Israeli reports from 1991. This is Mickey, and this is what used to be his house in Savion. There was the alarm, and he wanted to move to the safe room. He didn't have enough time. Suddenly there was darkness and something very, very quiet. And he found himself in this position. His entire body was locked in place. Nothing, he was excluded with no harm at all, not even a scratch. He just couldn't move. He could breathe freely, everything was free. Now, what are the odds that, remember, a reduced payload, of course, what are the odds that a house will collapse like this and he would survive? And this is just one example. By the way, a war is a war. His two dogs did not survive. They didn't make it. So let's get to I'd like to show the second Lebanon war. In Israel, generally the second Lebanon war is considered as a stain, blemish on the victories of the IDF. I'm not a critic of the IDF. I just want to mention one thing. From point of view of statistics, it's really almost an open mirror. God could not reveal himself more without breaking all the rules of history. 390 rocks. Let me tell you the story of Tzfat. The war started suddenly with no alarm, nothing. It was about 2 o'clock. Bang, the rocket, a direct hit in a shopping mall in Tzfat. It was Mertaz Tzli. You have relatives in Tzfat? It's a shopping mall, one of the largest in Tzfat, and suddenly a direct hit of a rocket. Now, the target, the range is 50 kilometers. So there's no house to survive. Somehow, no damage. The rocket exploded, no damage. A second rocket follows immediately, 2 or 3 minutes later, bang, a direct hit on the same roof, and the house survived. Not the house, the building. People were awestruck. They asked the engineer, his name is Shifrit, tell me, what kind of miracle have you done? What building could survive a direct hit of a rocket? He laughed and said, like that. when you build a shopping mall, you usually divide the load. I don't know how many tons it is, but you divide the load by usually parallel beams, I think. Beams. Concrete, fortified concrete beams. So you spread the load evenly. Okay? Now, for his own aesthetic reasons, he decided to calculate for a different concept. One central beam, extra, heavily fortified, to support the entire load of the beam. The first rocket hit the roof, but on the roof was the central air conditioning system. Now, by the way, that's usually a bad idea. First of all, it's a relatively very large construction. Now it's exposed to the environment and especially to direct sun. It's a loss of energy. Usually you put it alongside in a shadow or at least a partial shadow, and it's also much more accessible to repair, to put it on the roof doesn't make a lot of sense. Now what happens is the rocket explodes in two stages. The first stage is there is a mechanism that explodes in direct contact. After about half a second, it starts a chain of explosion that explodes the main explosive. Why is this? So that if the rocket hits the target, by the kinetic energy it penetrates, so the result of the explosion causes a lot more damage. So what happened is that when the rocket hit the roof of the central conditioning air conditioning mechanism, it set up the chain, and when it penetrated it, it exploded, and in fact there were almost no remains of all the air conditioning mechanism, but the building was intact. The second rocket hit straight at the 145 beam, and it simply could not destroy it. It was so strong because it was designed to withstand the entire load of the building. So you may call it, of course, luck or coincidence. Now, I don't have the hour or more that it would take me to compile all the list of coincidences. Let me just give you an example. Kiryat Shmone is a very small town, relatively small. In fact, if those of you who know Israel, been there, if you drive from one part, Tzomet Gomet, northern, it's on Highway 990, from Tzomet Gomet, the southern part of Kiryat Shmone, to Tzomet Tel Chai, the northern part, if there's no traffic problem, it takes 3 minutes. No kidding, I've driven there many, many times to traverse Kiryat Shmone, and again, more. It's a very nice, compact, mini town. Over 1,000 rockets hit Kiryat Shmone. Only two people were wounded. That's it. It's simply unbelievable. A rain of over 1,000 rockets over such a small area. Two people were wounded. Nahariya, 808 rockets. Two casualties. Sfat, 471, one casualty. Siberia, 180 rockets. Half of them were at the poorer people live. The residents are very crowded, and nobody understands how it's possible that almost 90 rockets hit such a small area, so densely populated. All the parking lots destroyed, all the garbage that there were places where garbage was collected, everything was destroyed, no building was hit, no person was hit. Again and again, that is the entire picture. Final figures.
Three thousand nine hundred fifty hit Jewish population in Jewish cities and villages. 20 rockets only in Arab villages. 19 Arabs. Again, statistically speaking, this is impossible. I mean, to attribute this to just natural phenomena, you know, random hitting rockets simply defies the mathematics. The Iron Dome was wonderful, but statistically speaking, you can compare the Tsuk Eitan. How do you translate it in English? Fortified rock? I don't know. I don't know the official content. The blue figure numbers 10, 8, 9, and the number of successes of the Iron Dome
system hitting missiles. These are the dates. Okay? August 12th, etc. The red are the total number of rockets that have been fired. Take for example August 20th. 168 rockets fired, 23 were destroyed by. What about the rest, 145? They hit empty islands. If you compare the figures here, you see that over 80% of the rockets fired, thousands of them, over 80% hit empty islands. Again, statistically, this is ridiculous. This is completely ridiculous. Hamas person in Gaza is going to say the God changes the path of our rockets in mid-air. I don't know if you can prove it. I doubt it if you can scientifically offer a proof. But I mean, we are not speaking about intercontinental ballistic missiles. We are speaking about rockets 20 kilometers, 30, 50, 70 kilometers in Ashdod. I work in a factory in Ashdod. Ashdod is, I mean, it's less than, I think, 1 minute. Flight is rocket. You have less than 1 minute to reach the shelter. If you have a shelter. That's all. I mean, how can you miss? I don't know, but the earth can. In short, it is true, if we look at the map, if we look at the facts, it's obvious. But we are not alone, and this is what I wanted to actually say. We are not alone. And if you ask yourself, oh yes, can you prove it? I think yes, I can prove it. Because I have a document that meets all logical requirements. It is authentic. It is clear. Every word in the language that is spoken today, it offers a blueprint, an entire history of a nation. Every part of it defines the history of other nations. Every part of it is unique. Every part is not something rational that can be extrapolated or explained logically. And yet, here we are, all facts behind us, testifying to the veracity of the document, to its not only being the true blueprint of history, it also offers what's going to happen in the future. But that, I think, is a subject for another lecture. So it's not only that we are not alone. We have the formula, because the Torah tells us. The Torah teaches us what has to be done, what needs to be done in order to bring back peace, redemption, and much more than this. We actually don't live in the dark. It is a challenge. It is very difficult. Or at least, I say it seems difficult. I became a Baal Teshuva 43 years ago with my wife. I was not looking for Judaism. I had been brought up in an anti-religious family, actually, and I'm ashamed to say, but I detested the Jewish people, and they looked to me like fossils coming alive, or worse, they looked to me like cavemen, and I felt like saying, please return to your prehistoric case and leave us alone. We are enlightened people, and this is how I felt. I found myself in a dialogue with a rabbi who was in the army, and slowly he refuted all my theories and all my ideas until the point where I said, okay, I agree, but of course it doesn't mean that you are right, because what you say is ridiculous. I said, okay, we can prove it. I can prove that God exists. I can prove that the Torah had been given in Sinai, etc., etc. And finally, I remember finding myself in an impossible situation in which my My mind told me it is true. It is the greatest truth ever presented to you. And I tried to refuse it from every possible way. It simply didn't work. I looked for Christianity. I looked for hope everywhere. It didn't work. So my mind told me that's the right thing to do. And my emotion said, no, I'm sorry, I can't. But Baruch Hashem, I crossed the lines. And I'm here. And I must tell you one thing. I remember keeping Shabbat. I mean, strictly keeping Shabbat. It looked like confining myself to imprisonment. And Kashrut, well, we can deal with it, but there were so many mitzvot that I said, I'm sorry, look, it's impossible for me. You know, you were born into this, so you don't know another way. I'm a cosmopolitan. I'm a scientist. I travel. I give lectures in scientific conferences. I mean, it's not for me. It looked really impossible. You know, the matter is, when I look back now, I don't know, it looks like prehistory to me, but I ask myself, could I live without the Shabbat? When I look at my family and my children and my grandchildren, sometimes I cry and I say to myself, I don't know why I was so lucky to be presented this, but I can't understand, actually, many years ago, how I could live without it. So when you're outside, it looks impossible. But people forget that we are not dealing with a meaningless ritual. Do this and do that. It's something external. It doesn't touch you. We are speaking of something that was molded to fit the soul, our inner spiritual qualities that we are not, I at least, was not even aware of. We change. We widen our horizons, our spiritual horizons. We add new dimensions to our lives. So from outside, it looks, wow, no way. But from the inside, it looks totally different. So the Torah not only proves that the author of the Torah is the owner of history, is the master of history, but also offers the prescription how to live peacefully, how to be able to live in an environment in which we can spiritually fulfill our aspiration. It may look difficult, but it's not. Lo b'shamayim, it's not. The first point was, rationally speaking, we can demonstrate that that is it. And I think that anyone reading the Torah, and I believe that all of you occasionally or regularly read the Torah, I suggest start looking at it also from the point of view of a blueprint for the history and reality of the Jewish people. Not as a story, not as history, not as an inspiration, but a document that is much more than story, history, and inspiration. It's something real. I think you will enjoy it. And I think also that in Rosh Hashanah, that confronts us very shortly, this could, in a way, help us uplift our skills. Shana Tova, Tiva Chatima Tova, and I'd like to thank very much Rabbi Stachik and the Langston family for hosting the lecture. And I would also like to thank you very much if you would like to fill in those questionnaire or kind of feedback form. This will also help us to relate to you and maybe offer other unofficial experiences. So you're kindly requested to fill this form if you like, and listen with Rabbi Stachik. Thank you very much. Shana Tova.
Rabbi Inbal, I think we're all officially speechless. You're the one who gave the speech, but we're really speechless. And I would like to tell you, when you return to your home and you're back together again with your six children and your 35 grandchildren, a couple on the way, Ezra Hashem, you can share with them the fact that you have a great discourse, that you're coming back knowing that you really inspired all of us. When we go into Rosh Hashanah, we're going to remember what you said, and Ezra Hashem, we're hoping to soar in our personal lives in a way that will hopefully bring the Gula
very, very, very speedily. I want to remind you that we have right here, we have the information, the flyer, about a very important lecture, another very important lecture coming up right between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. Well, we need some high octane gasoline. It's available right here. Also, these just came off the press. Brand new calendars that were just published by the yeshiva where I was ordained. They're excellent calendars. You are all welcome to help yourself to a copy. Have a safe trip home. We want to thank Julie and Bill for their spectacular hospitality. Everybody's invited to the dining room to partake in the wonderful refreshments that they have prepared. Have a safe trip home, everybody.